Since this podcast was recorded, the AHSN network has been renamed the Health Innovation Network. To find out more about the new names of the local health innovation networks described in this discussion as academic health science networks, visit thehealthinnovationnetwork.co.uk.
We know that prolonged stays in hospital are bad for patients, especially those who are frail or elderly. Nearly 350,000 patients spend more than 3 weeks in acute hospitals each year. I'm Nigel Thompson, and in the second of two podcasts, we'll be considering how the NHS Insights Prioritisation Programme has introduced new ways of helping patients get better without a lengthy stay in hospital. Stuart Jeffrey works within the Kent, Surrey and Sussex NIHR Applied Research Collaboration and has focused on the beneficial changes arising from the COVID-19 pandemic. But first, Professor Dame Caroline Watkins, Professor of Stroke and Older People's Care within the University of Central Lancashire's Faculty of Health and Care, explains how, when it comes to making changes, she believes collaboration is key.
Well, the things that we wanted to talk to you about today, I guess, are the things that have arisen through our collaborations within the Northwest around the Applied Research Collaboration, Northwest Coast, and with the Innovation Agency, which is the Academic Health Science Network of the Northwest Coast, with a lot of clinicians who have been trying to be innovative in trying to cope with the things that have been thrown at them during the pandemic. And they've done some great things, and they don't want to lose some of the great things that have happened during the pandemic and want to see how they can persuade people to fund things so that they can carry on.
What examples can you give us? Is there one thing that really comes to mind that you're particularly proud of or have been impressed by it?
Well, we've had a little bit of extra funding around a particular project. One of the things we found was that local neonatal units had been thinking innovatively about how to reduce the time that preterm babies were in hospital so that they could get home quickly and, you know, stay safe, but not just to go home earlier than they should have done, but to have extra support in doing that, and also to benefit from it because parents then get to be closer to their babies, not in a hospital environment, and can bond better with them and what have you. But it's not without its challenges.
And just tell us in more detail perhaps how that's worked. What kind of stories have you heard where parents have just, what, like you say, have had a closer, better bond at an earlier stage?
Yeah, so some of the babies that are born preterm, even those that are born sort of 34 weeks onwards, that's called sort of late preterm babies, they have problems feeding, perhaps with a little bit of breathing, so they need a bit of oxygen, and they often have jaundice and things that need sorting out, and normally all those things would require them to stay in hospital. So being in hospital is great and you've got, you know, all the experts around you, but it means that you can't relax in the same way with your new baby. And so enabling people to go home by giving them extra support with their feeding, helping them to perhaps have oxygen at home, be able to have perhaps light therapy at home, have somebody on the line for additional support over the phone. Those things have enabled people not just to go home earlier with their babies, but if they're worried about things, they've got somebody that they can quickly ring up and get support for without them having to go back into the hospital. And so people have thought that was, you know, very important thing that happened during COVID, and thought that it was a really important thing to try and carry on. And obviously during COVID, it was done with no additional resource. It was just a case of reorganising the hospital unit team to go and do outreach work. But obviously that's not sustainable in the long term. So what we're trying to do is to gather all the information that those services need to try and persuade commissioners and whoever else to put some funding in to try and keep these services going and also perhaps make them even better, because obviously they were set up in a hurry, and although people have benefited from them, they can also make suggestions about how they could be better. So things like, you know, having somebody to coordinate the services between the hospital and the community, because there are obviously other people in the community that the families can access as well. And having somebody to liaise about that, you know, has been quite an important thing.
It's funny, isn't it? The pandemic has obviously prompted people to make these changes at speed. And from what you're saying now, they're checking to make sure that they're sustainable and it's the right thing to do.
Exactly, because they're not without problems, and different people in different circumstances may need things to be slightly different. So that's what we're trying to do now. We're trying to interview parents and staff to see what's been good and what could have been done differently, and to think then how the services can be enhanced to make sure going forward that they're not just better, but very much better than they have been. And we need to understand what works for some people in some circumstances and doesn't work for other people in different circumstances. So we've got to get much better at learning from the changes that we make.
That's good to hear. Thank you for that. And joining us also is Stuart Jeffrey. Stuart's a Senior Research Fellow with the National Institute for Health and Care Research, the Applied Research Collaboration for Kent, Surrey and Sussex. I saw you nodding along to that conversation, Stuart. I know you've been looking at discharging from hospitals. I guess this is something that's close to your heart as well.
Yeah, and clearly Caroline's been looking at the paediatric or newborn end. My research is very much focused on older people, I think. We've been looking at discharge to assess, getting people out of hospital to free up hospital beds for others a little bit earlier than perhaps they would have traditionally left hospital. And discharge to assess has been around for 20 years ago. I was a clinician doing this, leading teams doing this. So it's been around certainly for 20, probably 30 years as a concept. But during COVID, the government threw quite a lot of cash at each hospital, each IC, integrated care board. And it was sort of supercharged a fair bit because of the obvious benefits, particularly during COVID and still now with the pressures that hospitals are feeling. So we've gone out and evaluated these larger discharge to assess programs that have been around for 3 years now and come up with a series of issues that we think, you know, everyone's doing it, but are they doing it the best they can? And just a series of prompts and pointers to say, have you thought about this? Have you thought about that? Have you got these bits in place? Because it can sort of improve the efficiency quite nicely.
So it's a very big change for some people, especially the culture of organisations, hospitals, where, you know, there's been a very set route for a patient to finally leave. So to try and sort of come back a bit and suggest a different way of working, has that been quite hard to achieve and for people to buy into it?
Yeah, absolutely. And with this particular pathway, it's not just the hospitals, but it's, as a pathway, it involves multiple providers in health and social care. And whilst the hospitals, you know, that they are they've got a frame of reference of when somebody can go home, actually changing that and that, changing their understanding of the risks that can be managed in the community is something that, you know, we found still needs to happen in places. So as a community person, you can kind of look at someone and say, yeah, that we can manage that. But if you've spent your life working in a hospital, sometimes you know those edges don't quite meet. And similarly, so some people will go through a bedded facility, perhaps a nursing home or a residential home for a short period. And actually, rather than just admitting somebody to be supported there, making sure that the culture within that home is one of enablement rather than pure supportiveness. So helping people get back on their feet, in effect. That does take a bit of change and a bit of a culture change.
And can I ask you both, when it comes to making both your programs involve a change of activity, a change of route, how has technology helped? The fact that there is digital technology and we can monitor remotely now, has that made a real difference?
Well, I think there was recourse to traditional sort of phone lines and what have you. But I think going forwards, there's an opportunity to use more sort of video conferencing and being able to demonstrate things digitally. There may be more monitoring equipment that can be monitored remotely as opposed to just locally. So I think there can be made more use of technology if we think about it and if the funding's available. I know it sometimes it is that provision of kit that stops people going home. I know from early supported discharge services for stroke patients that one of the key barriers, I was just thinking about it when Stuart was talking, was actually getting aids and adaptations. So something quite straightforward like a handrail could prevent people from being able to go home. So, I think we it doesn't have to be high tech and it doesn't have to be expensive.
Yeah, I think that's really a really important point. There seems to be this desire for apps and an online monitoring. And yes, that is kind of being rolled out and used. But actually, some of the basics aren't there. The adaptations that Caroline mentioned, are really, really helpful. But also things like shared records and particularly between health and social care. You'd think we're, 30, 40 years into the age of the internet and IT, everything on IT, and yet we still haven't, in most places, we haven't managed to get a record that follows you from hospital to home. We kind of got to break that technology barrier very soon, I think.
Do you think it's close? I was had an involvement with the hospital recently. I was texted to remind me of the appointment. Literally, I've just in the last half an hour had another text saying, "How was the treatment between 0 to 5? How would you rate it?" So it seems that once you're in the system, as it were, if you prove that you're able to make use of the iPhone or something like that, the system will come and meet you. But if you're not able to reach that point, you're still pen and paper, phone, things like that. We're not quite there yet, are we?
I think the key bit is it's the transition of care between providers and sectors that causes the problem. Within a hospital, the tech you've just talked about, it's really well advanced, it's good, it's stable. But actually, moving somebody from hospital through a community NHS service into social care, you've kind of got these barriers, and it's breaking down those barriers that is proving the key problem. It's all very, very possible. The barriers are not technological. They are governance and people and culture more than anything. And a bit of money, probably, because, money is important when you're buying tech.
Yes, I'm aware that one of the local trusts in East Lancs, they've set up a rehabilitation service using video conferencing. And so they've had employed additional people within the trust. It's called Enroll. They've employed additional people within the trust to actually support patients and carers and the staff in getting familiar with the technology and troubleshooting after the patients have gone home. And although it started in one trust and has been facilitated through East Lancs, now it's going to be rolled out across Northwest Coast. And that's a fantastic thing that people will be able to get rehabilitation from their own home without, having to travel long distances, and all facilitated, yes, through screens, which is kind of good. I know it's not exactly the same as having a person in the room with you, but I think it means that people can get more time than they would have otherwise.
I don't know, stroke is an area of expertise for yourself, Caroline. When it comes to recovering from stroke, do you get to a point where you can do it online? You don't need to go, because and perhaps as a trade-off, it's actually more invasive or harder work, for somebody who's recovering from a stroke to go to a hospital, to sit in a waiting room, to then to be seen, to go home. Whereas if it's like almost like a sort of catch-up or how are you doing progress report, it's easier and it's less, causes less damage maybe by doing it this way virtually.
Exactly. And I think it's similar for, other older people as well, in actual fact, particularly care home residents, often they can't go to follow-up appointments at all because somebody would need to go with them. and that isn't always available, and that's a shame if they miss out on follow-up. But I think one of the programs that we've got started with Stroke now across Northwest Coast is motivational interviewing, so a talk-based therapy delivered over the phone or on a video, so that people can have psychological support after they go home. And again, that wouldn't have been available in the past. It wouldn't have been an option. Either the staff would have had to have gone to them, or they would have had to travel somewhere. So it means that, you know, more people can get input more economically than they would have done in the past.
And what do you think the NHS Insights prioritisation programme is basically aimed at, I guess, capitalising on what's happened after COVID and making sure it is robust for the future? What are your views on this programme? How is it working, and what difference do you think it's made?
Well, Stuart, were you going to answer that one?
First of all, Caroline, I'm going to have to contact you after the show, because my last clinical job was in community stroke rehab, early supported discharge. So yeah, we've got a lot in common.
All right, okay.
but the NIP program, to use the acronym, which is a fun acronym, I think. I think it's been really good. You know, it's brought together. In particular, it's brought together AHSNs and ARCs in a way that has really cemented those relationships around the country, from what I can see. You know, we do have different focuses in the way we work, but actually, the combined strengths of both are really powerful. So I think as a facilitator for future work, it's been fantastic. In terms of the programs, I've been leading the Kent Surrey Sussex one for 18 months, and it's really good. You know, the working relationships, the findings we've got have been great. The capacity we've had to do stuff has been superb. And you know, we've been able to really engage with integrated care boards and say, you know, is this working for you? Are we doing the things that will make a difference to the NHS, but also ultimately to patients?
Yes, and I think the funding of the NIP programme has been quite important as well, because when you work with people in the NHS and with the Academic Health Science Networks, they always get dreadfully impatient with academics, because if you want to apply for funding, it's going to take an awful long time to get that money through. So the NIP programme, providing that funding in a relatively speedy way to allow you to collect information, you know, in real time when it's useful, to be able to gather that information quickly in the short term is an important thing. And I think it should be a lesson learned that that kind of funding needs to be available to gather the information when it's needed, rather than, you know, by the time, I know some of previous research that we've done, by the time you've done it, that the whole landscape has changed. And so we need to get more NIP type funding available to capture things, because if you want to make changes in the NHS and in the community, then you want to do it now, really, but you don't want to do it without understanding the benefits of that change. Because I always say, you know, it's great to make change, but you really have to understand that you're changing things for the better, and to understand whether it is better for everyone, or if there's something that doesn't quite work out as you planned when it's people in different circumstances. So I think it's been good in that way. Like you say, working collaboratively across the patch, been a great thing.
I think that's a really interesting point, Caroline. And, you know, the one thing I've noticed, I've only been in academia for a couple of years, and the one thing I've noticed is that the more applied research, the speed at which I would have wanted it in the NHS doesn't match the speed at which academia has been able to start from the initial sandpit ideas through to bidding and actually delivering it. You know, you're talking 3 to 5 years. And actually, when I was a manager in the NHS, I wanted stuff done. Well, I wanted it done last week. But, you know, a few months, 6 months a year would have been absolutely fantastic to do it in. And I think that NIP funding has helped some of that. So, I that's a really good point.
It's interesting what you say. This is a recurring theme, or two recurring themes of this series of podcasts we've recorded about NIP. The first is what you just said, that it's, you know, the fact that money was on tap and you could use it straight away. And the second point is collaboration. The fact that because of the pandemic, people had to collaborate. There wasn't time to go through the various kind of chains of command. It was a case of, we need to do it quick. And I wonder, just final point to you, both of you, you know, looking to the future now, do you think that we've really sprinted forward because of the pandemic and the work that you're doing now? Are you confident, if not optimistic, maybe confident might be the right word, that in the future, the work you're doing today will soon be in effect far quicker than it would have been 5 or 10 years ago?
I hope so. I mean, I think we still need to apply for further funding to make sure that when things are introduced, that we actually do that in a research framework. You know, I think I would always say that, and some people would raise their eyes to heaven. But I do think that we need to capture more information than we do to understand about the pros and cons of doing, you know, when we introduce changes. And maybe we can think, you know, one of the things that we've come across is the difficulties there are in extracting data that's routinely collected and marrying the data from one source up with another source for individual patients to understand what they went through in different parts of the pathway. And I think there are great strides been made in those things, but I think it all still is a bit clunky. And it would be great if that routinely collected data was more readily extractable, so that we could have ongoing evaluation of changes as they're implemented over a wide area, without the inconvenience, I think, to patients and carers about all the information sheets and consent forms and, you know, having to fill in vastly long questionnaires. You know, we need to get a bit smarter about how we monitor things, I think.
I think during COVID, we heard a lot of comments around, you know, not returning to the old ways of working, but, you know, building a new enhanced society and so forth, and avoiding that return to business as usual. And obviously, a lot of what's happened since the pandemic started to ease is, you know, we've kind of ended up heading back to business as usual because it's comfortable and it's what we've missed and it's everything we want. But actually, it's probably not right for the future. So I think the one of the advantages of in a micro way, I suppose, compared to the rest of the society, you know, having something that has helped that leap forward in relationships and ways of working, particularly between ARCs and AHSNs and academia and the NHS, I think it's been really, really positive because it's not business as usual. It's not what we were doing, but it's what we can do and have demonstrated we're able to do for the future. So I think there has been a bit of a leap there, which is very good.
And I think it's facilitated people meeting more, not just clinicians, not just academics, not just, you know, ICSs, but we've been able to meet with patients and carers and include them in meetings to get their views on what we're thinking about and, you know, get them to tell us what we should be doing. And again, it, as well as it sort of being good for sort of clinical care and you can have it in your own home, patient and public involvement can also be enhanced because people don't necessarily need to go out. And I do know, yes, I realise that it's not a medium that works for everybody, but it does mean that some people can contribute when they wouldn't have been able to easily. And I think the more we listen to patients and carers, the better we get at doing things in a way that's acceptable and that not just hits the target, but, you know, meets the point as well.
Thanks to Professor Dame Caroline Watkins, Professor of Stroke and Older People's Care within the University of Central Lancashire's Faculty of Health and Care, and also to Stuart Jeffrey of the Kent, Surrey and Sussex NIHR Applied Research Collaboration. If you'd like to learn more about the NHS Insights Prioritisation Programme, go to the AHSN Network website. I'm Nigel Thompson. Until next time, thanks for listening.
physical health and mental